Okay, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host today, Bob McChesney. It is a live show in the studio at Campbell Hall here on the University of Illinois campus, Sunday, June 15th, 2003. Today we're going to be talking about U.S. foreign policy, the war in Iraq, the war on terrorism. And to do so, we're going to be joined by a special guest, Rahul Mahajan. Rahul Mahajan is a peace activist and scholar who's worked on a wide variety of issues. And he's published a couple of books. The first book came out last year, The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He's got a brand new book coming out, published by Seven Stories Press this month, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Rahul Mahajan's been very active down in Austin, Texas, in the No War Collective, where he's joined by Robert Jensen, who was a guest on this program not too long ago. He's written widely for a number of publications, USA Today, Newsday, Baltimore Sun, Dallas Morning News, Monthly Review, among others. He's a prolific writer, and it's our pleasure to welcome to the show. Rahul, are you there? Great to have you on Media Matters today.
Great to be here, Bob.
Now, you just flew in from out of town. You're back home in Austin, is that right?
That's right.
Well, you didn't hear it. I gave you a warm and wonderful introduction, which I even told about your PhD in theoretical physics. Which I think makes you unique among people writing about foreign policy in the United States today.
A great credential, no doubt.
I've known you, I think we first met 3 or 4 years ago when I came down to Austin to give some talks and had a chance to spend a lot of time with you. And you've been very interested in foreign policy, U.S. Global politics, and the U.S. role in the world, and peace issues for many years now. And your new book is called Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Has that actually been released yet, or is it forthcoming?
It is out. I've seen copies in print, and it'll be in bookstores within a matter of weeks.
Okay, terrific. Why don't you tell our listeners here on Media Matters what the theme of the book is, what the argument is. Give a general overview of the book for our listeners.
Well, the overview is basically it is an overview of the new Bush imperial policy as opposed to the empire building or imperialism of previous administrations. This is a new one about which there's little debate. I mean, it's funny that both the defenders of the policy and the critics of it refer to it clearly as imperialism. So I sort of look at some of the strategy documents of the neoconservatives who are now running the policy and isolate what I think are the four basic components of this new imperial policy, which are, you know, military transformation, you know, extraordinarily rapid technological advance for total military superiority, expansion of the network of military bases, regime change, which is to say a change from the most common policy in the 90s of really trying to control the policies of other governments by tying economic strings to them, mostly through multilateral institutions like the IMF, World Bank, and WTO. The regime change, on the other hand, is an openly colonial stated policy of saying, you know, if we don't like a government, we'll go in and remove it, and of course we will replace it not with a democracy, but with a very closely held military client state. Much like we did in many countries after World War II. And finally, of course, no surprise to anyone, control over production and transport of the world's oil supplies.
Okay, and that's the new book, Full Spectrum Dominance, that you've just written. Well, the timing was pretty good, if I may say so. I don't think you planned it necessarily. Maybe you did have it come out in the midst of a major war in Iraq. The war is so-called over. What is your sense? How would you analyze the war? If someone says, wasn't this a great victory for the United States? We went in there, we kicked some butt, we got rid of this terrible guy, Saddam Hussein. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that the neocons right now run.
We have listeners who might not be familiar with that term. What do you mean by neocon?
Neoconservatives, basically. Chief ones in the administration include people like Paul Wolfowitz, who's the Deputy Secretary of Defense, I. Lewis Libby, who's Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Elliot Abrams, who has actually played a prominent role in the Reagan administration as well, and of course there's Richard Perle, who is an unofficial unofficial part of the administration as well on the Advisory Defense Policy Board. And they have been planning a huge gamble. I mean, they call it democratizing the Middle East, but what it is really an openly imperial policy of some kind of colonialist domination of the Middle East. And so far, you know, they've done the easy stuff. I mean, it's funny to see all this commentary saying, well, we proved we could do it. And nobody really who, with any sense, was doubting that we could do what we've done so far, which is to beat the hell out of a country which was almost unable to defend itself. I mean, even less able to defend itself than the average third world country the United States might pit itself against, and made even more so by the fact that we first used the United Nations to proceed in the disarming of Iraq before we did it. The difficult part, and the part that's the real gamble, is something that they have absolutely not proved they can do. To pacify the country, to rule it with some kind of tightly held, either openly colonial or you know, slightly disguised colonial client state, without inspiring massive resentment. And you're seeing already the way it's backfiring, and it's making it very difficult for them to control. So on the one hand, even the pre-assembled Iraqi elite, I mean Iraqi opposition groups, which were basically very close to the U.S. government, are not playing ball fully. They have not simply allowed the United States to impose such a puppet regime, and so the so-called democratization process has to be put off. On the other hand, you're seeing that they've managed to do something that nobody in Iraq could ever do, which is to unite Saddam loyalists, Ba'ath Party people with Islamists in opposing the American occupation.
Well, there were three basic claims that were provided by the United States government to justify the invasion at varying times and to different audiences. So one was the weapons of mass destruction, which we'll talk about later. Another was the connection of Saddam Hussein in the Iraqi government to the terrorists, the al-Qaeda terrorist network, and terrorism in general. And the third was that Saddam Hussein was just a really terrible, awful person, and his had a deplorable human rights record as a leader. And therefore, the United States should do the world a favor, get rid of him, and establish a viable democratic society in the Middle East, a region that is filled with lousy governments and dictatorships. Well, the third one is the one we're talking about now. The first two we'll talk about in a second. I mean, the path to democracy seems to have really stalled. I mean, it sounds like what you're describing, what we read about in the media or hear about, is a government that's very far from being a democracy.
Yes, I mean, the third one of those claims was certainly true, unlike the first two. But it was a bit of a non sequitur, because if you look at U.S. policy in the region, you see they have no commitment to replacing bad regimes with good ones. And if the regime they create in Iraq is in some ways better than Saddam's, and surely it will be better in some ways and even possibly worse in others, it will be an accident. I mean, it will simply be because that was consistent with their real goals in the region, which they have already said very clearly. Their goals for Iraq are establishment of permanent military bases, privatization of Iraq's oil, which is to say denationalization, taking it out of the hands of Iraq's people and putting it in the hands of foreign, especially American corporations. And the democratization process, such as it is clearly showing this. So when they could not control these political groups, even though they were, as I said, largely hand-picked, they first of all put off the process, and then about 10 days ago announced something dramatically new, which nobody in Iraq is happy with, which is that the process will be continuation of the military occupation authority, which will at some point in the future pick somewhere between 25 to 30 Iraqi political figures. Again, they will be totally picked by the United States military, and those people will convene a constitutional convention. And it's interesting, you know, the Times of London, when they reported this, they used the phrase constitutional convention in quotes, because it's so clearly going to be a sham. I mean, these hand-picked people are going to pick their own delegates. They're going to be brought together in a room by the U.S. military. They're going to be given a draft constitution by an American law professor, who's at least one of the candidates has already been profiled in the New York Times as a possibility to write the Constitution of Iraq, and it will be the most open sham of any kind of democratic process since the Afghan Loya Jirga.
We're talking today to Rahul Mahajan on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. It's a live show today, so we are accepting and looking forward to getting phone calls. The phone number here is 333-9455. If you want to make a toll-free call, the number is 1-800-222-9455. Rahul Mahajan is the author of the new book, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, which has just been published by Seven Stories Press. He's the author of another book, which came out 1 year ago, The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism, which was published by Monthly Review Press. I've had the privilege of reading both these books and strongly recommend, if you're interested in these issues, these are very well-written, introductory, coherent overviews of the crucial issues at play here. So please do call in. What's the weather like down in Austin today, Rahul?
It's hot.
Well, up here it is absolutely delightful. So I hope we do have some listeners. And in fact, we do have someone who's called in right now. So let's go immediately to the phone lines. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Rahul Mahajan.
Explain to me something about this ideology behind this push for world domination. I just don't understand the logic of it. It seems morally, ethically, rationally, politically, economically, disastrous. And I think that Machiavelli would probably call these people bumbling bulls in a china shop. So, and maybe it's just that I've read too much about Taoism and knowing that when you think you're strong, you're probably very weak. These people are called neoconservatives. There seems to be, a very conservative wing of Christianity that supports them, perhaps certain Republicans that have always felt there should be less government. They seem to confuse God with nationalism. But can you explain, what is behind this and whether it's rational?
Well, first of all, I think we should distinguish that the Bush administration is composed of welding together two political strains which are really very different. So the neoconservatives are not small government people in any way.
Right.
They are the proponents of an open military-based empire, which actually requires more military spending, and presumably some of them are not very happy about the tax cut, because as the U.S. gears up for more explicit global dominance, it's undercutting the tax base that's necessary to fund that. On the other hand, you have hard right types like, for example, Dick Cheney, who are at least there's a balance. I mean, they both balance corporate and overtly military interests, but the Cheney types are more interested in the corporate interests, especially very narrowly conceived things like oil. So what I think is happening here with the current foreign policy, which is the neoconservatives, it's not the other side, is in a sense the military strategy is very, very risky but brilliantly conceived. I think their strategy planning is far, far deeper than that in the Clinton administration, and it's largely based on gaining explicit control of Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Central Asia, a swath of the world around which apparently right now it seems global dominance will be built. There was a time when it was much more seemed to be the Far East, but this is the new area which is really key to the current plans for U.S. global dominance. At the same time, the other strand, I mean, there's these two strands in U.S. strategic thinking, the military and the economic. They're largely ignoring the economic, except in the sense of the narrow interests of U.S. oil companies and certain other corporations, and they're ignoring the threats to the stability of the global economy that they're bringing in with this open rift, for example, between the United States and Europe.
Yes, that's what I'm wondering about. Seems like we're going to have some kind of backwash or backlash. They think that they can just dominate and everyone's going to lay down and bow to them.
They have the reasons for thinking that. It's very, very difficult to oppose U.S. power, but there is absolutely no doubt that a counterforce is growing. And of course, the most exciting counterforce is what the New York Times has already called the world's second superpower, which is global public opinion, which manifested in the run-up to this war in a way that it never has in history before.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for calling. If I can follow up on her points, Rahul Mahajan. First of all, it seems like that one of the lines we heard throughout the 1990s and early into the early year before 9/11 was a notion that the world was evolving in such a way, and this wasn't simply a mainstream position, I think this is a position that had credence across the political spectrum, that traditional splits between countries, like the rivalries between nation states, were being undermined by the rise of global markets and the economy, so that the investor wealthy classes in Britain, France, United States, Japan, and Nigeria, for that matter, all shared sort of a common bond, the idea that their governments would be fighting with each other. It didn't make as much sense anymore because there was this global marketplace. And then what we're seeing since 9/11 and what you're writing about and talking about, this new Bush administration doctrine, seems to be a very much a strong return to the idea that there's a national stake here and there are national contests between governments and regions over who's going to get the control over the world economy. What's going on here?
Well, the initial perception you're talking about, I mean, there was a lot of truth to it, that the, you know, the emergence of a transnational global corporate elite, although I think the equivalence of first world and third world corporate elites was dramatically overstated. I mean, what happened was, once you could spread a so-called level playing field for capitalist competition throughout the world, you found that first world corporations were much better able to compete. And so, you know, and if you look at, say, the top 100 corporations in the world over the past 10 or 12 years, the share of European corporations increased a fair amount, the share of U.S. corporations increased dramatically, and the number of third world and even of Japanese corporations actually decreased in the top 100. So this emergence of this elite was really also the emergence of the U.S. and Europe as even more economically dominant over the rest of the world. But one of the things that has been changing is that the initial payoffs that you could give to third world elites are now less. So the first, you know, the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which was passed in 1994, you could say, well, other countries are at least getting a codified set of rules with some kind of equality between first world and third world in terms of tariffs and quotas and other kinds of restrictions. Later on, however, you're seeing things like the assault on this push with intellectual property rights, which is essentially going to destroy the you know, things like the drug industry of India, which provides very cheap drugs to the people and is going to lead potentially to you know, massive deaths from disease. You're seeing pushes toward water privatization, where basically first world corporations are going to come in and sell water to the people of the third world. These are things for which, you know, there's a few third world elites who can get very rich off corruption and bribery and so on, but in general, they're not benefiting third world elite classes as much, even in conception, as the first part of the free trade agenda. And I think part of what's happening there is that it takes more and more coercion and force to push this agenda further into the third world. And the other thing is, of course, the U.S.-Europe split, where the United States maintains this incredible political dominance, even though it doesn't have economic dominance, and in fact it has a huge liability of a tremendous balance of payments deficit, something previous empires have been very careful to avoid, but something that the United States actually requires in order to keep the populace more or less quiescent, although fortunately there are signs that the populace is growing less quiescent.
We're talking today to Rahul Mahajan on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Mahajan is the author of the new book, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. If you'd like to call in and ask a question or make a comment, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, and our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Rahul Mahajan.
I'd like you to draw some historical parallels to other countries that have been occupied, i.e., the United States after World War II occupied both Germany and Japan, neither of which we can say is not a democracy and is not doing economically well, if not stagnant. They are still powerful countries economically. Why couldn't Iraq be one more great democracy like that?
Well, first of all, the United States did not create great democracies in Japan and Germany. I mean, yes, the governments it created had slightly more democratic representation than the ones they replaced. But what was really the primary consideration for the United States was creating governments which would fit neatly and very subserviently into a new sort of military imperial network that the United States was building. So, for example, no matter how much appearance of democracy there was in Japan, the United States could always get Japan to sign security agreements and renew them even when there was massive popular opposition. Japan has never opposed a U.S. war. Japan actually pays a great deal of the cost of the U.S. maintaining its military bases there, including especially in Okinawa. Those bases were crucial, for example, in fighting the Vietnam War and were a key part of U.S. force projection in Asia. So somehow they created so-called democracies in which their U.S. foreign policy was never crossed by the government, even though the majority of the population very much opposed it. The first really serious crossing of U.S. foreign policy by Germany was with Gerhard Schroeder's run for re-election and this current war on Iraq. And to date, Japan has basically never really crossed the United States in a major way. So this is the primary consideration in creating these new governments as well. They should fit very nicely into the...
Yeah, but if you look at how do they handle their own people? Now, it seems like there's civil rights in Germany. If you make a contract, somebody's going to pay. If you, for some reason, cross them, in the civil sphere, you're going to be treated as if you have rights. All of these things have value too. I mean, you talk about Iraq in the global scheme of things, those people have been beat up for generations. Shouldn't they have some voice in their own democracy? I mean, do you think the United States let just anybody make the constitution of Germany and Japan? No, they picked people who they wanted, who would give the people the rights that they needed. They are also economic considerations because there was an opposition at the time.
Well, I'm not sure what exactly what point you're trying to make, but it seems very clear to me.
We're going
to
pick. Countries act in their own best interest.
Let me finish. That it seems
I would not
clear to me
be
that
involved
a constitution.
With that kind of government.
Caller, let him finish his point. Let him finish his point then, caller.
The constitution for Iraq should be drafted by the Iraqi people after a full process of political consultation among Iraqi society. It should not be drafted by someone picked by the United States government and approved by a hand-picked group of delegates who have nothing to do with representing the Iraqi people.
What if they pick something we don't want after we paid to have that dictator removed?
Excuse me?
What if they pick something that we don't like after we pay to have that dictator removed?
It was the Iraqi people who paid, and they paid a very heavy price during the U.S. maintained sanctions.
They paid and paid, but the dictator never left. It took an American military force to move in there and make that dictator leave.
And the price paid even at
the
end,
there?
Even in that last stage, was paid mostly by Iraqis. Likely over 20,000 Iraqis were killed. The United States moved in with making absolutely no provision to provide even basic services in Iraq. There's a cholera epidemic in southern Iraq because the United States is doing even less to provide services than Saddam's government was. And to talk about the United States having paid a cost and thus having a right to create a government in Iraq that it wants is, I think, just morally indefensible.
All right, well, caller.
Who else is going to do it then?
The Iraqi people, they want to do it. Look, they're out in the streets saying we want to control our own political process. And the United States is very often shooting them.
If they could control their own political process, why didn't they rise up and get rid of that dictator?
Very often shooting them when they are out in the streets in peaceful demonstrations. In fact, a total of over 50 Iraqis have been killed by the U.S. military for taking part in peaceful demonstrations.
What, we should pack up and leave and just let anybody run the place?
Let the Iraqis run the place. It's their country.
Who says the strongest won't just run right up to the top again?
It's happened here as well, so it's not as if the United States tries to keep that from happening.
Well, who says if we left, something good would happen? I mean,
who says the United States has any right to control?
There are people there who are waiting just for the United States to get tired of it and leave so that business can go right back to usual. Do you think we should just let that happen?
There is no prospect of business.
Caller, let the guest answer, please.
Yeah, try to actually, you know, read the news and find out what's going on in Iraq. You don't actually have to go very far. I mean, it's true that the coverage in the mainstream media is horrible, and on broadcast since the war has been unbelievable. But all you have to do is read the New York Times to find out there's a lot of political unrest in Iraqi society, and there's a real thirst for democracy, but their own democracy, a political process that they control, not one that is imposed on them by the United States for the benefit of U.S. corporations and the grandiose imperial plans of the Bush administration.
Well, caller, thanks for calling. I'm going to go on to our next caller now. We've got line two from Champaign. Line two, you're on the air with Rahul Mahajan.
Hello. I'm calling because actually I found the last caller's comments to be quite disturbing. And I noticed that the last caller made the comment, what happens if they do things that we don't like? He seems to not understand the idea of democracy. In a democracy, the people have the right to decide what they want and not what the U.S. government imposes. And that's my comment, and I really appreciate your service and coming to us today.
Thank you.
All right, well, thank you very much. And if someone else would like to call in, the number is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Our guest today, Rahul Mahajan, author of the new book, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. And let me take this moment to tell you that Media Matters, this show, has a weekly listserv. And what we do is we send out emails once a week with the announcement of who the forthcoming guest will be and links to their books and articles or biographical information, forthcoming shows after that, material about our previous shows, oftentimes links to articles or books that they've written, so you can stay on top of this. If you're interested in getting on our Media Matters listserv, just send an email to our erstwhile producer, Ben Scott, and his email address is dbscott@uiuc.edu, and just say subscribe to Media Matters, and Ben will get you hooked up. We don't use this for spam or junk mail, and you can get off anytime you want. Just say unsubscribe. So I'd urge you to do that. Several hundred people have done it, and it's been a very popular phenomenon. Let's go back to the phone lines now. They are filling up, as I imagine they would. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Rahul Mahajan.
Hi, Mr. Mahajan. I have just a quick question for you. Earlier, when you were speaking about transnational corporations, you talked about the dominance of U.S. corporations and European ones. And I wanted to know how many of these U.S. corporations are actually based in the U.S. and how many of these European corporations are actually Western European, and I mean England, France, and Germany. And if you're using the word European as shorthand for Western European, why do you think that's important to do? That's it.
Well, when I say U.S. corporations, I mean ones that are based in the U.S., although, of course, transnational corporations have multiple bases of operations in addition to their primary one. And I think, I guess the reason that one uses European now instead of Western European is, you know, the emergence of the European Union. Of course, it is true that these are Western European corporations I'm talking about almost exclusively.
Okay, you know, and before we go to our next caller, let me say that I've been reminded by my producer, Kumi Silva, that if you do want to get onto the listserv email service I just referred to, probably best email her, and her email is kumis@uiuc.edu. That's kumis, kumis@uiuc.edu. So please join up. I think you'll be pleased you do. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Rahul Mahajan.
Hi, thank you very much for giving us this opportunity today. You mentioned earlier that Iraqi's oil was previously a national program that was in the control of the people, and I was wondering if you could compare and contrast for us the previous oil program and what we're likely to see now that the Bush administration is, in essence, has great plans to take it over.
Well, what we've seen is that the United Nations, the Security Council, which was split over the war, has now healed that split, and contrary to any demurrals of Jacques Chirac of France, has really retroactively legitimized the war by passing a resolution saying essentially that control of Iraq's oil money now belongs to the United States, which is to say the military occupying authority can create the body that controls Iraq's oil, so therefore essentially the United States controls current oil revenues. The United States will not move to denationalize the oil until there is some kind of government that it can at least claim is an Iraqi government, because otherwise it would be politically explosive even beyond what has happened so far. Again, already, you know, there's more and more open admission that oil was a major factor in the war, and in fact, it's clear, I think, without any detailed analysis, that it was the primary factor in this new kind of imperial force projection. But the United States is going to have to create this some kind of Iraqi interim government before it can move forward with that. So in the end, you're going to see, I mean, it's interesting, there's been this all these scandals about, you know, Saddam's billions and the claims that perhaps he and his cronies siphoned off somewhere from 5 to 10% of Iraq's oil revenues. This is minuscule compared to presumably the 30, 40, 50% that will be siphoned off by foreign corporations to their shareholders once the oil is denationalized.
You know, Rahul Mahajan, while we have you here, let's talk on this point. The other two issues that were presented widely, besides the concern about democratizing Iraq and making it a better place to live for the Iraqi people, the other two points that were given as rationales for the war prominently were one, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and in fact, legally, this was the legal reason given, that the United States had a justification for invading this country because it was an imminent threat to the United States with its production of these weapons of mass destruction. And the second reason related to that, but not given as the legal reason for the war, as I understood it, was that Iraq was connected to the Al-Qaeda terrorist group and was encouraging it. And by getting rid of Saddam Hussein, it would be a serious blow against the threat of terrorism to the United States. Why don't you, since those are such crucial factors that until the war began were given as the main reason for the war to mobilize popular support for the war and linking the war to the 9/11 attacks, for example, which was done routinely, why don't we talk about those two? They've sort of fallen from view in recent times. And what's your assessment of those two claims and where they stand now?
Yeah, well, there were two categories of legal reasons. One was based on actual international law and, you know, the fact that Iraq was at least in technical violation of numerous UN Security Council resolutions. Those related to weapons of mass destruction. There was also the very, very quasi-legal reason of the so-called preemption doctrine, which is a real innovation. I mean, there's no basis for it in international law, and it clearly violates the UN Charter. And there they could talk about both some putative threat from weapons of mass destruction and possibly some links with al-Qaeda. So what has happened is, of course, the claims of the links with al-Qaeda had collapsed even before the war, and nothing has been done in any meaningful way to resuscitate them. You know, things got to the point where when bin Laden came on with another tape saying that Muslims should oppose the war in Iraq, but calling Saddam Hussein and his government a government of socialists and infidels. And, of course, the only thing he hates worse than an infidel is a socialist, or maybe it's the other way around. That tape in which he denounced the government of Iraq and said he'd be happy to see it go into the dustbin of history was taken by Colin Powell as somehow proof that bin Laden and Hussein had colluded. I mean, it was really, they had no claims to make, so they had to fall back on this kind of nonsense. And a British intelligence survey showed that although there had been some talks at some time in the past between lower-level members of each organization, they couldn't build any cooperation because they're so politically different, and so there was no evidence of any links whatsoever. On the weapons of mass destruction, again, you know, I think people can be forgiven. According to poll results I've seen recently, over 30% of Americans believe that weapons of mass destruction were found, and over 20% of Americans believe that Iraq used weapons of mass destruction in the war. And the reason they did was the constant breathless reporting, especially by Fox News, but you saw it also on the other cable news channels to a significant degree, and even in places like the New York Times. Every time there was some random allegation that some fine might have to do with weapons of mass destruction, it was printed, and not always with the full demurrals, and on Fox without even any pretense of a demurral. And so, you know, those things came up and they died very quickly. Sometimes the lifespan of one of these claims was less than 24 hours, but the constant saturation had this impact on the people. And now the claim is, well, there's not weapons of mass destruction, but it really doesn't matter. You know, we liberated Iraq from this evil guy Saddam, so the fact that we systematically lied, and of course many of the claims about weapons of mass destruction were open lies, the fact that we systematically lied to get the country into war is now deemed irrelevant. And I think we have to once again make the case that it is very relevant. We can, you know, there's a lot to be said, as we did, about how this is not a liberation of Iraq, but even if it were, it shows an open contempt for any kind of democratic process in this country that they essentially deliberately colluded to lie. We know from Paul Wolfowitz, for example, that they chose to go with the weapons of mass destruction claim at a certain time because that was the only claim that all government agencies could agree on. But when they couldn't substantiate it, they moved on to something else. And what they basically did is use whatever argument they could to deceive people into agreeing to the war, and now claim that it doesn't matter what arguments they use. Just, you know, violates the fundamental notion of, you know, informed consent by the public.
We're talking to Rahul Mahajan on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a caller who's impatiently waiting. We'll get to in a second. If you'd like to join us, the number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Before we get to the caller who's been so patient, I'd like to just complete this point. Tony Blair in England and Britain, who's the British government, was the number one ally of the United States in the war in Iraq. He, too, like President Bush, promised the people of Britain that the reason for this war was to get rid of these weapons of mass destruction, which were a threat to not just the region, but the entire world, including Britain and the United States. And he now is in a bit of a political firestorm in Britain, far more than President Bush is, for the fact that no weapons have been produced. And they're saying, you know, you took us to a war based on a lie. What's the story here? Why is Tony Blair in hotter water in Britain than George Bush is in the United States, when in fact George Bush, you know, is even more guilty of explicitly lying?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that the British public take international law a little bit more seriously, partly because here, the mainstream pundits and the government officials constantly denigrate the notion of international law. They don't do it as much in Britain. Another is that, you know, Tony Blair is from the nominally left party there, although it's hard to tell whether they are left of the Tories, and he's facing considerable dissent from within his own party. And the last is, I think, you know, ever since World War II, there's been the explicit creation of this political culture of total lack of executive accountability on foreign policy questions. That broke down, and there was some accountability in the early and mid-70s, but it really, the gap was closed once again during the Reagan administration. And there's this sense from mainstream political figures on all sides, people in Congress, that, you know, you may for some pragmatic reasons oppose a war before it happens, but you don't want to seriously hold anyone to account, any president and his aides to account for the claims they made once that war is over.
We're talking
until that changes, you know.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Rahul Mahajan on Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 3, Urbani, you've been very patient. Thank you. You're on the air.
I had a couple of questions. First of all, you had mentioned earlier that you thought 20,000 Iraqis had been killed during the conflict, and there was a large-scale cholera epidemic. Where are you getting this information?
Well, there is no really good tally, although an increasing number of reports about civilian deaths. For example, if you look at IraqBodyCount.net, which is simply a place where they survey all...
But where are they getting there? Is that what your source is?
About telling to tell you. They survey all mainstream media reports of civilian deaths. And if you look at their website, you can find out exactly what their methodology is. They estimate somewhere from 5,000 to 7,000, the last time I checked, civilian deaths. There are other estimates, of course, and the only thing that's clear is that most of these estimates have to be underestimates because not everything gets reported. In terms of military, there's not many articles about this, but again, you can generally see estimates ranging from 10 to 15,000 Iraqi military killed during the course of the war. You know, in terms of the cholera epidemic, you know, you can just look at the reports of the World Health Organization.
Well, I mean, the fact that there are numerous, statements out there in terms of the number of deaths and the like doesn't mean necessarily that one should, you know, grasp at the, at any one of them particularly. I think it'll be years before we know how many were killed in the war. I also wanted to ask you something about your belief that democracy, I mean, clearly democratization of Iraq is key. I'd like to ask you if the United States military would suddenly, and the British military, would leave Iraq, what do you think would happen within the next, let's say, weeks in Iraq? Would a democracy emerge, and if so, how?
Well, there are two different things to say. One is that while the United States is occupying the country, it is making sure that the political process that it creates is not a democratic one. But, of course, I'm not just in favor of the U.S. occupying the country and creating a more democratic process, partly because I think that's simply a contradiction in terms. Foreign imperial powers...
well, let's say you were... Okay, the U.S. military...
Caller, let him finish his point, then you can follow up.
Foreign imperial powers, when they create governments, always create governments that they think will serve their interests in the United States.
You're not addressing the question. The question is what would
happen
if the U.S. military would leave.
Hey, caller, I'll tell you what, that's the deal. Let him finish his point, then you can do follow up, okay? That's fair enough. Let him finish his point first, though.
And the United States has already said what its interests are in Iraq, which is military bases for regional force projection and privatization of oil. So they're going to create a government that does that. So one is that they could keep the occupation and theoretically at least allow a more democratic process to emerge, although that's really politically impossible. The second is the question of what would happen if they actually lifted the military occupation. And there it's fairly clear that there may well be a need for some kind of neutral stabilization force. And, of course, there is no neutral force in the world, but you can hardly find a less neutral force than one made up of the nations that went to war, that committed aggressive war against Iraq. So it's likely that a better alternative, I mean, certainly a better alternative in a world where there is no perfect alternative, would be a multinational force under UN auspices, which has no participation from any of the aggressor nations or from countries like France and Russia, which have such major interests in Iraq, but only from other countries, to simply stabilize the country, not to control it so tightly as did the UN Protectorate in East Timor, but simply to stabilize it while, it's going to take a long time for a full process of political consultation among Iraqis to emerge.
Caller, why don't you make a follow-up, and then we'll go on to our other callers.
Okay. I somehow, looking at the UN performance in former Yugoslavia, I'm not terribly confident that a neutral arrangement could achieve democracy. I'm still mystified as to how we get to democracy from the current situation. I'll leave it there.
Okay.
If you look in the former Yugoslavia, it's not really a UN performance. I mean, look at the Constitution of Bosnia. The Constitution of Bosnia commits that country to a free market economy. And it also commits Bosnia to having the director of the central bank be a foreigner. These are things that were inserted by the United States. You know, so yes, technically the UN would be better than the United States, but not if the United States essentially controls the process anyway, as it has done in Bosnia. And in Kosovo, of course, it's even much more explicit. There's a gigantic U.S. military base there, Camp Bondsteel, and Kosovo is really much more of a U.S. protectorate than anything else.
Okay, let's go back to our phone lines. Line 1, Charleston, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Rahul Mahajan.
Hi. I'd just like to raise actually more of a comment than a question with relevance to an earlier caller who brought up the occupations of Japan and Germany, because I think that issue maybe deserves a little more depth of discussion than you were able to have at that time. I thought the caller did raise some valid points, especially with regard to domestic Germany, that domestically it is a fairly open parliamentary democracy with proportional representation, has many excellent services that rival, if not surpass, those of the United States. But I think it needs to be addressed why the current situation in Iraq is not the same as the situation after World War II. And there's an excellent article about this by historian John Dower in a recent issue of Boston Review. I think it was the March-April issue.
And that's available online, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it is. They have an excellent website. And he points out that although, of course, the self-interests of American elites were never far from the minds of those who occupied Germany and Japan, that at that time there was a lot more idealism. The New Deal was still alive. There was not the same contempt for democracy, domestically that exists now in the Bush administration. There was strong support for union rights, labor rights, and things of that sort among the occupying forces. And perhaps most importantly, neither Germany nor Japan had a critical strategic resource like oil that the United States wanted to exploit. So anyway, I'll hang up and see if you want to elaborate on that in any way.
Well, thank you very much, caller.
Yeah, what those things that John Dower said are certainly true, but I think he gives a picture that I consider inaccurate. Yes, there was a real debate, a foreign policy debate, for example, between 1945 and 1950. There was a real opening up in Japan under MacArthur in the first couple of years of the occupation. That was quickly closed down as soon as the Japanese really mobilized and there was a threat of a massive wave of strikes and a general uprising. Both Japan and Germany were not created to be democracies. Japan to this day is not much of a democracy. It's largely a one-party state where even on this war the prime minister could openly and sort of cravenly support the U.S. war in defiance of the will of 80% of the people. In Germany, again, the United States not only did not do denazification, it very often went through and put Nazi officials at the lower levels back into positions of power. This is hardly the essence of democratization. The country, you know, in the 1960s, when The Sound of Music came out, they censored the last third of the movie in Germany because they didn't want to have any depiction of the Nazis doing anything bad. I think the country didn't really start to democratize in a meaningful way until Willy Brandt, and this was against the will, in spite of the United States, and not because of it. These other things are true about the difference in the world situation today, but I think it's really inaccurate to think the United States wanted democracy in Germany and Japan in any meaningful sense.
Okay, we're talking to Rahul Mahajan today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have one more caller who's been very patiently waiting. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air.
There's more of a comment to remarks about why U.S. and U.K. troops should stay longer in Iraq to restore democracy. If restoring democracy is the primary concern, then those of us who sort of support it should also think about how Bush came to power here. He came to power by not allowing more than 400,000 black voters in Florida, by denying them the right to vote. So if you're really concerned about democracy here, then should we allow some other power, some other democratically elected power, to send in troops and liberate us here? Would this be okay with those who support having U.S. and U.K. troops in Iraq? Thanks.
All right. Rahul?
It was actually 58,000, mostly African-American. But, yes, it is true, it was a pretty blatant violation of democratic procedures. As I think has been frequently pointed out, and you know, democracy should begin at home. But on the other hand, I think it's very clear that it is not a matter of the United States bringing democracy to Iraq.
Now, one of the issues, Rahul Mahajan, that has been made more recently has been that even people say, okay, look, the reason we took over Iraq and invaded it were bogus. It was imperial. It's a real terrible thing the United States has done in the big scheme of things, and it's not good for making the world safer for democracy, peace, or the fight against terrorism. But at least what it's doing is it's forcing the United States to broker a peace between Israel and Palestine and settle that very troublesome issue in the center of the Middle East. Now that there's a peace that the United States is really strongly pushing in a way that it hasn't for quite some time, what do you make of that argument?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, that's what you would get from reading the newspapers, but the truth is almost exactly the reverse, and it's a parallel to the emergence of the Oslo process after the Gulf War, although this time around, it's, if you can imagine it, even far worse for the Palestinians. So what Oslo was basically, in large part, the United States using a newfound regional dominance in the Middle East as a result of the Gulf War, including a dramatically increased military presence and the fact that the Palestinians had lost support from most of the Arab nations, to, along with Israel, force on the Palestinians a process that was basically this: create a Palestinian client state to police and repress Palestinian resistance to the occupation so that Israel would be enabled to cement the occupation, which is what they did. It was not an accident that the rate of settlement building during Oslo doubled, for example. It was part of deliberate policy to cement an occupation of somewhere between 50% and 60% of the West Bank. What's happened now is even worse. I mean, basically, the United States has a tremendously greater level of regional dominance. Israel and the United States have together, again, under the name of democracy, which is a theme that's emerging a lot recently, have imposed on the Palestinians an even more explicit client state. At least Arafat was identified with the nation, was the leader that people looked to, did get democratically elected in an election in 1996. Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, the current prime minister, who has really now been put in as the power in place of Arafat, has not been elected, has no popular support, and his job is explicitly to crush all resistance, not just terrorism, not just armed resistance in the occupied territories, but presumably all the exciting new nonviolent resistances of eliminating roadblocks and getting through roadblocks and violating curfews that are going on between both Palestinians and people like members of the International Solidarity Movement. His job is to wipe out all of that resistance so that Israel can this time make sure that it's not the whole West Bank that's being fought over, it's a very small part of it. If you look at the wall that is being built in the occupied territories right now, the projections are that it will close roughly 40% of the West Bank, and that is all that Ariel Sharon is likely to give. And even that will be temporary, because the debate in Israel right now is not between occupation and withdrawal in elite circles, but rather between occupation of Oslo-style apartheid occupation and what they like to call transfer, which is some long-term plans to make conditions of life in Palestine so difficult that there is a mass exodus. So this so-called resumption of the peace process is actually a step up in the repression of the Palestinians and the cementing of the Israeli occupation.
Well, you know, it looks like the time is winding down for us today, Rahul Mahajan. I want to thank you very much for being our guest on Media Matters.
Thank you.
And I will stay in touch with you. Rahul Mahajan is the author of the new book, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, which has just been published by Seven Stories Press and should be available in fine booksellers everywhere, both electronically and in bricks and mortar. Next week on Media Matters, our guest will be Michael Albert, the editor and founder of Z Magazine and now the proprietor and webmaster of ZNet. The following week, we're going to have Andre Schifrin, legendary book editor from New York and now the current president and lead editor at New Press, but a long, distinguished career in book publishing, to talk about what's been happening in the book publishing industry. I want to thank all of you for listening, as always. Please join us next week. Brett, our engineer, Kumi Silva, my producer, who's done a wonderful job for me. And finally, I want to thank Juice McPickles and Hambone for being there. I'm Bob McChesney, and I will see you all in 167 hours. Thank you.